Hi everyone, thank you all for coming in for the eighth lecture of the machine learning course. So today we're gonna focus on, we're gonna tr make a tr transition from supervised learning to unsupervised learning. So we're gonna focus on examples of unsupervised learning tasks, and we're gonna also specifically talk about one example of unsupervised learning task called principal component analysis, or PCA. So I'm gonna talk more in more details about that later on. But before going into that, I just wanted to provide a brief overview about what we have learned in the course so far in terms of supervised learning. So if you recall, like in that context, we have a data set which has data points, X, and also labels. And the goal was to instead, like, so initially in the course I mentioned the word fit, but I guess now it's better to use the word learn, because fitting a function might not be ideal because of what we have seen in terms of overfitting. So now we have to learn a function such that our function fits our labels to a very good approximation, to the best extent we can. Okay, and we have ex seen examples of such functions. So we learned about linear regression, and that's in the context where these labels are continuous. We could also use logistic regression. This is in the case where these labels are discrete. And generically, for both regression and classification, we could use, for instance, a feedforward neural network, or as we have seen in the previous lecture, a convolutional neural network if, for instance, we're dealing with pictures or with other sort of configurations that have, for instance, translation invariance. Okay? And of course, we have seen ways we could optimize these functions using gradient descent, and we've seen examples of overfitting where we're given some training data where we could only fit the training data and do poor on the testing data. So we've seen ways to cure that. So in case you have any questions about this, feel free to let me know. I'll be happy to go back to that part again with you. But in this, in the rest of the two, in the next two lectures, we'll focus on unsupervised learning, where the goal is to learn some sort of structural properties of data that don't have labels. Okay. So now in this case, the data set is given by a set of data points without labels, so there is no Y. And such that each data point is the same as we've seen before. So again, maybe to be consistent with what we've seen before, n would be the x that we've seen in the very beginning. So that's the dimensionality of each data point. And assuming that m is the number of data points that we have in our data set, okay? So this is the setting that we're gonna use for today's and also for tomorrow's lecture. And in today's lecture, we're going to see two examples. So in this lecture, I'm going to focus on dimensionality reduction as an example of unsupervised learning. And in the next lecture, I'm going to talk about how we can do generative modeling, which I'm going to briefly define in today's lecture. And we're going to talk about more in the following lectures as well. Okay? So let's get started with the dimensionality reduction. Okay, so this is something that we'll see today and in the next lecture, and also in the tutorial next week, not on Tuesday, but on Friday next week. And also you'll have a chance to learn more about this in the homework. So hopefully if you didn't manage to understand everything, you'll have another chance to complete your understanding in the following tasks. Okay, so the idea here is that given some like data set in a higher dimensional space where n is something that's larger than three dimensions that can't be visualized in three dimensions. The idea is to reduce the dimensionality to something that we can see in real life, either to two dimensions or three dimensions. So what this means is that, so you want to go from a data set with dimensionality n to another data set with dimensionality n prime, such that n prime is either equal to 2 or 3. Okay, so to something that we can easily visualize. And for sure that 2 and 3 are what we can visualize in real life. And an example of this would be the visualization of the different phases of matter, for instance, in the Eisen model. And as an example, if we could do something like the following, where we only have two dimensions, x1 prime and x2 prime, where we have one cluster of data points over here, and one cluster over here, and one cluster over here, and we have something like data points in this cluster, and other data points in this cluster. Such that these, for instance, correspond to the paramagnetic phase. And such that these other two clusters correspond to the ferromagnetic phase. Okay, so if we could do something like this, where we have data points that belong to the space of n spins, so that's an n-dimensional vector, and if we could squeeze it to two dimensions where we have these kind of clustering, that would be very helpful, so that we can distinguish different phases of matter. Of course, in the case of the Eisen model, we already know what's the physics, so that's just a proof of principle. But you can imagine that you could extend this for other systems where we don't know what's the physics, where we could use these tools of dimensional reduction in unsupervised learning to distinguish potentially different phases of matter, okay? Even though that we don't have the labels necessarily. Okay? So that's the main idea of dimensionality reduction. There's also the case of generative modeling. So I'm going to provide a brief description before we go into principal components analysis. Before explaining, like, briefly what's generative modeling, are there any questions? Okay, so far so good. Okay. So briefly, generative modeling consists of, again, the same sort of data set where we have only data points without labels. But now the goal is, instead of doing dimensionality reduction, we want instead to find the probability of distribution of the data set. So given some data sets of some data points that don't have labels, what we want is to learn. We want to learn the probability distribution that's actually provided us with these data points. Okay. So this will become clearer, hopefully, later on. One example of this could be, for instance, if you're familiar with the Boltzmann distribution. So if you sample from this Boltzmann distribution, you would get this data set. But if you don't know what's the Boltzmann distribution, can you start from the data set and go back to learn the Boltzmann distribution? That's, in practice, very hard to obtain if you do the calculation exactly. Okay, so that could be one example. For instance, in real life, like if you have like a bunch of images, can you learn what's the probability of of those images in real life. So, and you know that this property is something that's also high dimensional and is very hard to get. So this techniques of generative modeling allows to do the inverse of going from the data set that without labels to an approximation of this data probability distribution. Okay, so having said that, now let me focus on the task of dimensionality reduction in this lecture, where we'll focus on an algorithm called principal component analysis. Using PCA. Okay, so the idea is again similar to that, to the general purpose of dimensionality reduction is to generate a lower representation or a lower dimensional representation of the data, or which consists of n dimensional data points. But now what's specific about this architecture, this algorithm PCA, is that we do it using linear transformations. Okay, so I'm going to clarify that later on. Okay. Okay, so today's lecture will be more about this algorithm, which has linear transformations. In the next lecture, we're going to use another algorithm that has nonlinear transformations. Okay. So before explaining the math, I just wanted to show you a quick visualization that will hopefully help you to understand the math behind principal component analysis. Okay, so let me share the screen. Okay, so here a very nice visualization of PCA in this website that I'm going to share later on in the references on the portal. So here we're given some original data set where I have 5 data points in 2 dimensions. So of course that's not a good example because we're going to go from 2D to 2D, but it's going to become clear as I'm explaining why that's interesting. So what we're doing here, basically what PCA does is that it does some sort of linear transformation. It's like an affine transformation with some rotation in such a way that the new data points are given by the following. Okay, so you have some new axis, PC1 and PC2. And what's interesting about the fact that we do these kind of transformation is that if you look at the x-axis over here and the y-axis, you see that the variations are almost the same of the data points. Okay. So the range of variations is almost comparable. But now if you go to the new axis, like a new axis PC1 and PC2, you see that the variation along PC1 is larger compared to the variation compared to PC2. Okay? So basically PCA consists of doing a linear transformation in such a way that you find that some axis that has the most variation or the largest variance, technically speaking, for the data distribution. That's a way to separate the data to different clusters. Of course, in 2D, it's already visible. We can already tell that those are 2 different clusters. But for instance, if you have a more complicated example like this one in 3D, then if we could find an axis, for instance, PC1 over here has the highest variation compared to PC2 and PC3. So that's, as you can see in this picture, that's the axis where we could see the largest variation compared to different axes. As you can see, while we rotate in the 3D plane, you see that there are lots of lots of axes where we cannot see the variation very well. So you could imagine that if we go to 4D and much higher dimensions, this will be much tougher. So this is like the idea is to find the axes in such a way that we have the highest variation and only use like one or only use two or three of those axes where we have the highest variation in order as a way to do dimensionality reduction. Okay. So now this is like the visualization. Now what I'm going to spend on the next in the rest of this lecture, what I'm going to show you is like what's going on behind the math of this algorithm. Okay. But before ending this this demo, are there any questions? Is the principle clear for you? Okay. So let's get started. Yeah, so that's because like you want, so for instance, in that example, that axis X1 is the axis where we have the highest variation where we could see different clusters. Okay. So for instance, if we are in a, if we are like in higher dimensions, like where we have axis where the variation is almost the same, will be very hard to separate the separated data. But if we can find one axis where we have the highest variation, that's where we could see.
The idea is that we want to cluster data, right?
Yeah, so that's the idea. Like, if we don't know what's the, so here we know what are the labels, but if we don't know what are those labels, if we find different clusters, then this means that there could be different physics in the two configurations. It's a great question, yeah.
Does big variance always guarantee that we will have clustering? Can they be like homogeneously distributed?
Yeah, so there is a limitation of PCA in particular, where if you have, for instance, like some sort of physics where you have, for instance, order parameters that are nonlinear, then it turns out that this is not enough. So you need to consider nonlinear methods. For instance, the one we're going to learn about next lecture. And for sure, like there is always a limitation to these methods. So when we can manage to do clustering, that's great. And if we cannot, then we need to consider other methods. Okay. So that's the first method you have to think about when you want to do clustering of different data points. Okay. So now, in order to find what is the axis where we have the most variation. Let us first define this big matrix, which consists of all the data points x1, x2, until xm, where, again, m is the number of data points that we have in our data set. And you could see this as a big matrix. So if we expand each vector, so for instance, if we expand x1, we will have x1, 1, x1, 2, until x1n. Same thing for the second row. We will have x2, 1, x2, 2, until x2n, and so on and so forth, until the last data point, which we will have xm1, xm2, until xmn. Okay, so I haven't done anything. I just represented the data points in a format where I have a matrix that has size m by n. Okay, so that's the representation of the whole data set in a matrix. Now, what I need to do now is to define I need to shift all the means of the columns over here to zero. So this will become clearer later on. So I'm gonna define a new vector xic where I'm going to shift each data point by the average of all the other data points. Okay, so what this means is that if I write it in the coordinate system that I have here, I and j in the matrix, so this would mean that xi and j centered will be equal to xij minus, again, the average k from 1 to m. And again, here I will have xkj. Okay? And that's for all j from 1 to n, okay? Where n is the size of each data point, okay? So far, so good. Okay, so now, again here, I also wanted to highlight that I should go from 1 to m, okay? So now, what we need to do is to consider what's called the covariance matrix, which has the following definition. So I'm going to define a matrix called Vx that's basically called, that's defined as follows, as xc transpose times xc. And here I'm going to divide by this factor. Okay, so m minus 1. So if there is only 1 over m, you would understand this as some sort of covariant matrix. And it turns out that this minus 1 is a correction often used in statistics because of the fact that we have variables that are centered around zero. So in order to account for that, so because of this constraint, which reduces the number of degrees of freedom, we'll have to add this minus 1. And if you want to learn more about this, this is called the Bessel correction, just in case you want to see why there is a minus sign here. But it shouldn't matter if m is very large, okay? So just in case m is small, this is where it should matter. But typically, in real-world application, m is very large. This minus 1 shouldn't matter, okay? So the interpretation of this matrix is that the diagonal elements, so corresponds, so or store the variance of each component so this actually motivates so the fact that we have a variance motivate the fact that we actually subtract by the mean, because we know that the variance contains the average of the mean squared of the variable minus the mean. So that's why we can interpret this, like the diagonal elements, as the variance of each component, okay? So each component of x. Okay, so what I mean by components is like not through the data axis, but through the number of, the index of each data points, okay? And as you might guess as well, the off-diagonal elements would correspond to the covariance between different pair of components of X. So here we have some sort of a matrix that has these two informations, and the idea of BCA is to kind of make this to do a transformation on the data, a linear transformation on the data, in such a way that this covariance matrix becomes diagonal. So another way of saying it is that you want to kind of get rid of these covariances in such a way that our elements are kind of independent from each other, and we only end up with the variances on the diagonal, and at the end we can only pick the axis such as the variance is maximal. Okay, so when we have a non-zero covariance, it's hard to pick that axis, but if we can make this matrix diagonal, then we can actually find that axis where we have the largest variation more easily. Okay, is the philosophy clear for you? Okay, so let's do that. So let's find that axis where this matrix is diagonal. Okay,
I'm a bit confused. So this Vx should capture the variance of along the 1 to n this direction, right? The component direction.
So it should capture the variance along that component, right? So for instance, Vx11 should capture the variance along the first axis 1. Okay, so we should do statistics on all the data points along that along this column. Okay, same thing for Vx22. That will be that one, and the covariance will be actually the dependence on each component to the other. Okay, each pair of components
capture the variance between different data in some sense, right?
So between different data points, but on one component, not
one component, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So one here will be axis one. This will be axis two, until axis n. And we want to do a rotation in such a way that we find one axis where we have the largest variation. Okay. Okay, and just to clarify here, maybe that's a question for you. What will be the size of this matrix given that we have an m by n for the matrix X?
N by m?
Yeah, exactly. So that's an n by n matrix. Okay? So we want to diagonal. So that also makes sense why we'll have n variances for where each variance corresponds to different axes. Okay? So now let's find that matrix P. So let's find P such that after doing the transformation, we get some sort of new matrix Vx prime that's diagonal, where X prime is a transformation, a linear transformation on the data. So the reason why I'm multiplying by P on the right and not on the left is because here I have, so MXC is a matrix that has size n by n. So by compatibility, so P should have size n by n, right? So that I can get, again, a new matrix that has size n by n, okay? So is everything clear so far? Okay, and now if I do such a transformation, if I want to define this matrix Vx prime using that definition, so I'm going to use the definition above, so that will be X prime transpose X prime. And if I plug in the definition here for X prime, I will get 1 over n minus 1. And so I will have XCP transpose, and then again XCP. And with the transpose, I will have P transpose times XC transpose. And so I will get that P P transpose out, and also the P, I'll get it for on the left, on the right, and I'll get that factor 1 over n minus 1 inside. And at the end, it will end up with xc transpose times xc, which is nothing but the definition of vx, OK? So that will be p transpose vx times p, OK? And that's exactly the definition when that we use when we have a linear when we do like a transformation on a certain axis, on a certain basis to another basis, okay? Maybe I shouldn't have used, so maybe I should here clarify that if we have a basis transformation from like a set of axes to another set of axes, we should have p minus 1, right? Instead of p transpose. But because that we have this matrix Vx is a symmetric matrix. So if you apply the symmetrical Vx, you'll get the same thing. So that means that P minus 1, so that's the matrix for the transformation, it's actually equal to P transpose, okay? So this means actually that we're doing a transformation from one matrix in one basis to another basis, okay? And this is, again, supposed to be a diagonal matrix. Okay. So again, yeah, so since we have a symmetric matrix, this P minus 1 is equal to P transpose. In the eigenvectors, as if you know this in linear algebra, should be orthogonal as well. Okay. So in case this seems like, if you're not familiar with this, I would encourage you to meet with me after. Okay, so that I can clarify this for you after the lecture. Okay, so having said that Vx prime is a diagonal matrix, then we will have a form that looks like this, lambda 1, lambda 2, until lambda n. So we will have n eigenvalues, zeros on the diagonal, and lambda j, where j goes from one to n. So that should be equal to 1 over n minus 1 I going from 1 to m, and here we have xij prime squared. And because we're doing a linear transformation on the data points, then the mean of each data point of each component will be actually zero. So basically each eigenvalue will have the interpretation of a variance of the new components, okay? Xi okay, so the components x j. Okay. I think I have to remove the vector here. So it has to be xj. Yeah, let me know if this is not clear. I can go over it again, okay? But just to summarize, we managed to convert that matrix from looks like a non-diagonal matrix to a diagonal one, where we have the interpretation of each eigenvalue as the variance of the new components where we have rotated the axis into new axes where we can know what's the variance independently of the others. In this sense, we can sort the eigenvalues in such a way that we pick the one that has the largest variance. So without loss of generality, we can always assume that lambda 1 is bigger than lambda 2, lambda 3, and so on until lambda n. So that's without loss of generality. If we don't have that certain initially, we could always rearrange the axes in such a way that we have this arrangement. Okay. So, okay, so can I erase over here? Okay. Okay, so now if I were to plot a case of a data point where PCA is helpful, then if I plot the eigenvalues as a function of I, or the index where I goes from 1 to n, then I will have here 1, 2, 3, until n. So initially, I would have a very high value for lambda 1, and then a much smaller value, and then a much smaller value, and then values that are even smaller. Okay, so what this means is that if I pick 1 or 2 as the axes where I'm going to do the projection of my higher dimensional like data set into these lower dimensional representation where we only have one axis 1 and axis 2, then I can actually see the variation of the data in such a way that we could see something like this over here. Okay, so this, yeah.
The new axes that you get are always orthogonal to each other, right? Because P is an orthogonal matrix.
Yeah, so because, yeah, so that's because of the nice property that we have a symmetric matrix. So the new axes that we get are actually also orthogonal because we start from orthogonal axes initially, right? And that's a good point, yeah. Okay, so that's the case when PCA is useful. So you'll see something like this in the tutorial, not next tutorial, but the tutorial after on Friday next week. So you'll have a chance to have a plot like this for the Eisen model when you will have the configurations for the paramagnetic phase and also for the ferromagnetic phase. Okay? And a case where PCA will not be useful is when you'll have something like this. Here. So in this case, we will have eigenvalues or variances that are very close to each other. So in this sense, like you would, if you pick only one, two axes, like you'll still like you'll be very hard to get some clustering like this because these two axes do not reflect the mass variations that we have in the data. Okay. As opposed to, for instance, these two axes that have the largest, that correspond to the largest variances in the data. Yeah.
We haven't normalized our data, so you could get a very high variance because you've got something which is measuring in millions and something else which is measuring in.
Very good, yeah. That's a very good point. That's why it's good to consider what's called the variance ratio. So that corresponds to the ratio of one eigenvalue compared to the sum of all the other eigenvalues so that we get the number between 0 and 1. Yeah, that's a very good point. So, so we can define what's called the explained variance ratio. So that Ri, where Ri is equal to lambda I for given index I from 1 to n, and we divide by the sum of all the other eigenvalues. So in this sense, this should be a number between 0 and 1. Okay. Okay, so that handles the normalization that you mentioned. Yeah, a very good point. Okay, and finally, what I wanted to highlight is, yeah.
I still have questions. So
sure.
for example, if we suppose we consider a sample, random sample from a data, random sample from in a rectangle with the length to be L and width to be 1. So if there is random sample, then we know that it cannot be differentiated by any analysis because it's random sample. But during the in this calculation, we can find that the principal this eigenvalue along one dimension is very large. Is at the order of L, the other is order of 1. So I want to say if we do not pre-doing the normalization, then even use this explanation.
This over here?
I mean the RI.
Explain variance ratio.
Explain the variance ratio, we cannot, because in that scenario, they explain variance ratio for example, lambda 1 is very big compared to lambda 2. So that cannot.
So you're saying like if we have like one amplitude, like one lambda is order of magnitude larger than the other.
That cannot say much things. That we do not know if it is come from the because we don't normalize the data or because the
So but if you have like if you let's say you have that happening here, like let's say you have let's do one example, lambda 1 is equal to 1000, right?
Yeah.
And the lambda 2 is equal to 1.
Yeah.
Then if let's say we only have two eigenvalues, so R1 will be 1000 over 1001, still close to 1. But then R2 will be 1 over 1000.
Yeah.
That's close to 0. So this means that, well, axis 1 is where hand like is the axis where we have the largest variation in axis two. It could be some sort of noise that
I want to say in my example that I just said both two these two dimensions are noise.
So you're saying like even though like we have
from with the scenario, the first scenario is that we forgot to do the data normalization, the other is that we really have some feature along one direction.
I see. Yeah. So maybe like if you have like an example where that happens, I could discuss that more specifically for you. But ideally, what we're hoping at the end is that if we get an axis where this explained ratio is much larger than the other axes, this is where we will have that axis will correspond to the physical signal that we have in our data compared to the other axes. So for instance, in the Eisen model, you'll find that one axis would correspond to the magnetization of each configuration, which corresponds to exactly to the physical parameter that can distinguish between the different phases. Okay. And just so after the final comments, does that answer your question a bit? Maybe I could talk, but sure, yeah. So just to recap what we've seen so far for PCA, we have started from a certain axis, x1 and x2, and have done a rotation or transformation to new sort of axes x1 prime and x2 prime, where I have data points having the largest variation along x1 and the lowest variation compared to x2. Okay. So of course it doesn't look very useful in two dimensions, but you could imagine that if you go to much higher dimensions and if you project out everything to these to an axis like x1 prime and x2 prime, you'll be able to see clustering of the data if, for instance, we have only so we could have a clustering of two regions where I have two data points, for instance, in physical applications, these two clusters would correspond to two different phases. Okay? And before ending the lecture today, I thought I would also provide you with more visual explanations just to help you connect with what we've seen today. So let me share the screen again. So are there any questions so far? But yeah.
you're presenting the images in two dimensions. So would you go two different bases on those two most significant ones? You've talked about finding the most significant in terms of the magnitude.
Yeah.
But if you're going to actually plot, you probably want to use two dimensions. So are you going to use a high variance or a high variance?
Yeah, so ideally, like, if we have like only one axis that have the variance much that has like orders of magnitude larger or at least very large compared to the others, this is where we see see a very nice differentiation.
That's only plotting on one dimension. If you want to actually plot on a two-dimensional graph, you need to put your data points on the graph.
Yeah. So yeah, the next one, the next axis we choose is to actually correspond to the next largest.
Right.
Eigenvalue. That's a great point. Yeah, thank you. And again, if it's not possible to differentiate data points, we can go to the third largest eigenvalue or lambda 3. Okay, but beyond three dimensions, that's very hard to visualize. Okay, so let me show you slides over here. So actually, what these clusters are is actually these correspond to the MNIST data set. You know, the MNIST data set corresponds to numbers, hand-drawn digits from 1 to 10. And if we feed this to one unsupervised learning algorithm, this one is called TSNE, which we'll learn about next lecture. You'll see different clusters forming in over here. And if you count, you'll find almost 10. And this is actually a much nicer visualization here. So you'll see that if you do component the PCA on that's the plot on the left, you'll have a hard time to distinguish between the different handwritten digits. So that's actually one of the limitations of PCA. And if you wanna have a nicer clustering, you could use a non-dimensional method, which is TSNE, that we will see in the next lecture, and that's for the plots on the right. Okay, and if you also do this in three dimensions, you'll get even a nicer clustering. So this is what you will see in this animation over here. So the more axes you add, the better you can actually cluster. The largest we could do visualize is three dimensions, and this is what you see over here. And just to connect with what we've seen for supervised learning, for instance, the task that you'll do in the first homework is to do supervised learning on the different phases of the Eisen model, where we have two phases. And so we have the paramagnetic phase, which has label 0, and the ferromagnetic phase, which has label 1. And that task is to use a feed-forward neural network to get the correct prediction for each phase. Now, in this case, we already have the labels, but for unsupervised learning, we don't have the labels, so that you can imagine, again, the case of a physical system where we don't know what's the phases. So by just looking at the data, you could already tell by eye inspection that we have sort of two phases. So we have these configurations that look somewhat random, and those look somewhat more uniform, and that's some sort of like this is the same principle of unsupervised learning. So we could cluster these first random configurations into what we can call group 1, and these other configurations in what we can call group 2. But another clustering that one could do is having those darker ones, which corresponds to all spins up, into one group, and the others were mostly all spins down into another group. And this is exactly what we will see in the tutorial next week on Friday. So you'll see that for a relatively large system size for the Eisen model, you'll see a clustering when you plot the first the first significant components. So those are called the principal components. So this one is called the first principal components. And this one is called the second principal component. And you see here the paramagnetic phase, which corresponds to higher temperatures. And those phases correspond to the different ordered states. So typically these would correspond to all spins up, and these would correspond to mostly all spins down. Okay, so this is a nice illustration where PCA can help us to find different phases in this prototypical example. Okay, so this is just what I've said here. In this part on the right, I have phases where spins are mostly positive, and on the left, I have the ferromagnetic phase where spins are mostly negative. In the middle, I have the paramagnetic phase where the average of all spins are mostly zero because of the randomness. And as you'll see in the tutorial, in the homework, which will be posted early next week, we will see TSNE, which is a way to do also dimensional reduction. And you'll see that you'll have clusters that are actually much more nicer compared to PCA. So in this case, you'll see a better clustering compared to the previous algorithm. Okay, and so this is again the same clustering that we have before, but in different locations compared to PCA. Okay, so this is all I wanted to show you today for this lecture. I just before ending the lecture, just want to make sure if I didn't miss any clarification, like feel free to ask me any question.
You may not start off with vectors which are separated by their dimensionality. For example, for our test data, X is neither the data points, but it's actually two-dimensional.
Yeah.
So you would presumably need to start off by making sure that you have the separate dimensions separated.
Yeah, so if we're already in two dimensions, if we use PCA, then it might not be useful, because like what we do at the end of the day is some sort of rotation.
But if we're dealing with a square and we have it linearized, that's our input, and we treat it as one vector, we're not going to capture the dimensionality of vertical and horizontal at all.
Right, exactly, yeah. So that's a very good point, yeah. So and again, like if we go beyond, like if you go to 10 dimensions or like to even higher dimensions, this is where we could see the power of these methods. The examples I've gave for two dimensions, three dimensions are just for illustration purposes, for sure.
How are you going to know what the dimensionality of your data is if you start off just collecting data?
Oh yeah, so the dimensionality is what I meant by, it's actually hidden over here. Maybe I will bring the screen up again. So each data point will have n components. And this is actually what I meant by the dimensionality, the number of components.
When you start with your data, you've just got a whole collection of data. You don't know how many points there are in one dimension and how many of those points are in a different dimension. If I've got a square of 30 by 30, but all I'm getting is 900 data points, I have to somehow or other work out what these data points are actually telling me in order to recognize that there is a separate dimension here for horizontal and vertical. And I imagine if you've got a ton of data which is in 20 dimensions, it becomes almost impossible to say what you're even looking at.
Yeah, so at the end of the day, like what we hope is to get some different clusterings, right? Of different like data points in different regions, and what the meaning of each cluster is something that would be unknown. Of course, we need to do more further investigations.
It's more how do you divide up this original data into these vectors?
Also, your question is like, how do we write these data points into these vectors?
How do you actually decide what vectors go with the data?
Oh, okay. So, for instance, like one example we could do is. For instance, like for the configurations of the Ising model, x1 would be the value of the first spin, this one would be the value of the second spin, and this one would be the value of the last spin. Is that what you meant?
Yes, but the spins are actually on two dimensions. They're horizontal and vertical. You've got a grid, but you don't know necessarily.
I see. Yeah. So for that model, like we can assume that we already know what's the structure.
Right. My question is, if you don't know what the structure is,
Yeah, so in typical, I think this would, like, in typical applications, we would know what's the lattice. So for instance, if we have some sort of experiment where we know what's the architecture, then we would know the geometry where our spins live in. But you could also see that this vector is a one-dimensional, like, representation of the data where we don't have information about the lattice. So you could still work this out even if you don't know what's the lattice or the structure of your system, because at the end of the day, we want to know what are the first two principal components, x1 prime and x2 prime, that have the largest variation in the context of PCI. Okay, but of course this has limitations, like it doesn't work always, but it will work in the context of the Eisen model. And you'll see at the end of the tutorial next week on Friday that this largest, the principal component corresponds actually to the magnetization. And it turns out that magnetization is actually the value that allows, the order parameter that allows to distinguish between paramagnetic state and the ferromagnetic state. Okay. But does that answer your question? Okay. Are there any other questions? Okay, well, if not, let's end there. Thanks very much for your attention. Yeah. Have a great weekend.